from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The number of people who identify themselves as biracial has grown by over 30% in the past 10 years, by 50% among America's children. In the hour ahead, we explore the biracial and multiracial experience. Four people of mixed-race backgrounds will join us to talk about their life experience and their sense of identity. It's part of our occasional series, In My Experience, and we'd like to have you contribute your story as well. How has being biracial shaped your life experience? How do you contend with the "what box do I check" question? Being biracial, part of our In My Experience series. Next one, Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In the past 10 years, the number of Americans who identify themselves as biracial has increased by over 30% to 9 million Americans. And the biracial and multiracial experience is our focus in this hour of Forum. It's part of our ongoing series, In My Experience, that focuses on the personal stories of Northern California, and something we put together in coordination with KQED's Public Insight Network. We have four guests in our studio this morning who will be telling their stories about their own biracial and multiracial experience and how that has been life-shaping for them. But we'd also like to hear your story as well. So throughout the hour, we want to hear from your stories. And we'll go ahead and give out that number. We'll take those calls a little bit later in the program. But here's the number if you want to join us. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's meet the people who have joined us here this morning in our studio. Jonathan Chin says that growing up, he didn't look like his father, didn't look like his mother, didn't look like other Asian children. He is of Chinese, Mexican, Serbian, and French descent. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Rochelle Pardue Okimoto is here as well. She says she's often mistaken for being South American, Middle Eastern, or Indian. In reality, her father is African-American and her mother is white, and she says that being biracial has had a strong influence on her life experience. Rochelle, good morning.
Good morning.
Calvin McFarlane is here too. His father is African-American. His mother is Italian. He says he identifies as being culturally black and that as a child he was often stared at, prompting him to ask his mother why. Calvin McFarlane, good morning.
Good morning.
And Rini Yunye Kegi joins us as well. She says that being of mixed race has been the biggest direct and indirect determinant in her life. She is of Asian, Guatemalan, and Caucasian descent. Rini, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with that question, because each of you responded to our Public Insight Network survey about the way in which being of a multiracial, biracial background has influenced your life story. And so for you, Rini, you said it was the biggest determinant. How so?
That's a big question. I grew up in a small town in California in the 1970s and 80s. And I think that every time you go outside into the world, people look at you and sort of make determinations about you based on how you look. So I think that was a big factor. And also because I didn't look like anybody else in my town, I think there were one or two other Asian families, and they were Asian families. There was two biracial girls who I actually ended up being my best friends in the entire town. And I think that's part of it.
Do you remember, do you have a memory of when you first had a sense that, I don't look exactly like those around me? In fact, I don't look exactly like either of my parents.
Right. Well, I spent the first 6 years of my life in Guatemala. So I didn't look like most Guatemalans because I had sort of Asiatic eyes and, you know, and in the Latin American world, a lot of times, if you have indigenous blood, sometimes you might have similar eyes. That I think was good for me to be there. But when I came to the United States, it was kind of a shock to be in an all white town. So not only was it that I was acclimatized to that from birth, but it was a shock at age six to suddenly be in a world where everybody was white.
Jonathan Chin, you said in your survey response that, as I mentioned in the introduction, that you felt that sense of not really looking like – not only did you not look like anyone else, you didn't look like your dad, you didn't look like your mom, you didn't look exactly like other Asian American children. What was your first sense of that, and how did that affect, do you think, your own sense of who you were?
I think that's very interesting. Even today, for instance, this whole idea of looking like one thing or another or one ethnicity or another, I still get that today. For instance, I look very Hispanic, and when I give people my identification card, they look at me, or some people make comments or they ask more questions. So even today, I still get that a lot. Growing up, a lot of people would say, oh, you look more like your father from either your smile or your eyes. So it was either certain body parts or the way I sort of carried myself. So it was actually quite interesting, this whole idea of looking like one thing or another, which made me sort of actually, I didn't understand at the time growing up, you know, where what looks, how does that shape my identity? And it wasn't actually until I went to university that it all sort of came together, being able to discuss with other biracial students, that I really figured out that this is my identity, this is what I look like, and that looks don't necessarily have to do with your identity.
Do you identify then more or feel like there is a special common denominator with other people who are also of biracial backgrounds?
Oh, definitely. The way I see it, it's almost sort of like a snail shell that at the core identify as Hapa, which is a Hawaiian term meaning part Asian and part something else, which is made popular by Professor Kip Fulbeck. And so after, you know, sort of reading more and being able to discuss more and sort of finding out more, I did definitely identify with that. And then it sort of grows beyond that to Asian American, obviously American, and, you know, North American, I guess, beyond that, and as well as, you know, sort of political views and such. But from the actual, the deep down, I identify as Hapa.
Is that true for you as well, Rochelle Pardue Okamoto, that you feel a special identity and kinship with other people who come from that same background of being of different multiracial backgrounds?
Well, certainly. I have my own favorite Hapa. I married a Hapa. So my husband is half Japanese and half German. And when we met, that's actually one of the first conversations we ever had was, you know, what's your background? And he told me about his, and I told him about mine, and it was an instant connection that I don't even know if I ever had. Well, obviously, when you meet your husband, there's a special connection. So I had definitely a special connection through that, and I've really enjoyed being able to compare and contrast the experience of what it's like to be half white and half Asian versus half black and half white. We've had different experiences in that he looks more Caucasian and I look more African American. And so we do definitely get treated differently at different times. And
so even though on a percentage basis, you're both biracial,
right,
there's a difference in the way in which you're viewed. How has that played out? How are you viewed differently?
I just think that most people, when they see me, they're either kind of questioning, well, is that girl, you know, like I said, you know, from South America, or is she, you know, is she?
Who is she?
What is she? Who is she? And then other people, I think, kind of get me right off the bat. They're like, oh, that girl's, you know, black or half black. And my husband, he's more, his name is Japanese. And so I tell people about him and I talk about him being Japanese. And then when they meet him, they say, I thought you said he was Japanese, you know, because he's tall and he's fair and things like that.
So how do you answer the great who are you question? Do you resent it when people ask that? And how do you answer?
I don't resent it at all. I think I felt very uncomfortable when I was growing up. As I said in my biography, I'm half black and I'm half white, but I never met my African-American father, so I was raised primarily by my mother, and then sometimes she wasn't even in the picture, so it was my grandparents who were Caucasian, and then also my stepfather was kind of in and out of the picture, who's Caucasian, but his parents helped raise me as well, who are also Caucasian, so I've never met any African-American family member or even laid eyes on any African-American family member in my entire life. So it's given me a very unique perspective. You know, I grew up with completely Caucasian faces around me, and it definitely, you know, called into question when I was growing up. And I think I just kind of ignored it because that's how my family did. They just kind of were like, well, let's just treat her like everybody else. But it definitely shaped me in that, you know, I had to kind of figure out as I got older, well, what does it mean to be Black?
Rochelle Pardue Okamoto joining us this hour as we talk about our part of our series, In My Experience, the experience particularly that we're delving into this morning is the experience of being biracial. Calvin McFarlane also is with us. His father's Black, mom Italian. How do you answer the who are you question, Calvin?
I don't get who are you, or I didn't get what are you. I usually got the question is, or are you mixed, or what are you mixed with? But if I did get that question every once in a while, I would address them as I'm a human being first and foremost, and everything else is secondary. So I can relate to what Rochelle went through growing up with just my mother in an Italian household, and much of my exposure and family life was strictly with my mother's side of the family, and I didn't have really any connection with my father's side of the family until later in life. So I can definitely relate to that experience, and I found myself seeking out my African-American heritage later on in my adolescence to really find a true sense of my identity, at least the other part of my identity.
And what did you then discover?
What I discovered was that my father's side came from the West Indies, the Caribbean, Jamaica in particular, and that we came from a long line of Jamaicans and by way of Canada and Cuba, and there was this really strong lineage that I knew nothing about, but I had an aunt that reached out to me on my father's side that really immersed me in what our family background was about, and it really almost solidified the other part of my identity, if you will, and gave me a sense of pride and purpose, at least because I knew what I'm seeing as in society and as I walk into public. I am seen as an African American first and foremost because my features are so prominent: broad nose, thick lips, curly hair, and so. Being seen as that, but not really having a family exposure to identify with that was challenging. So when I did have that exposure, it really solidified the other part of my identity.
How do you, each of you, respond to that point that Calvin is making, that in a way this question of identity is not only your own to sort out, but you have to also deal with what other people see you? And as Calvin is saying, if he appears to be Black, then that's what people think regardless of how his own identity might be conceived. How have each of you dealt with that, the way in which people view you, regardless of how necessarily you view yourself, Rochelle?
Well, it was definitely difficult when I was growing up because I didn't have the tools, like you were saying, to kind of solidify my identity or have someone to talk to about what that other half meant. And I finally started kind of doing some exploration and trying to get involved with like African American groups when I was about 18 years old. And what I found was I kind of felt uncomfortable. I think I felt as uncomfortable as any other white person would feel going into that group. And I kind of finally came to the conclusion, like, why am I here? Am I here because I want to be here, or am I here because other people think I should be here? And then once I came to that conclusion, I was like, well, I'm just going to let things happen naturally. And if I happen to encounter African American people and befriend them, then that's fine, but I'm not going to force it. And so I didn't really make a lot of friends, but I've kind of slowly over the years, especially as I moved to the Bay Area, have made more friends that way.
And how do, when you joined the Black Student Union and since, how have you dealt with that? How do other Blacks relate to you? Do you feel a sense of questioning from those who are Black as well?
Well, when I was a kid, like junior high school was the first time I was ever really exposed to large groups of African-American people in school. The girls were really mean to me. The boys were really attracted to me. And I just felt like kind of overwhelmed by both of those scenarios. And I just kind of, you know, continued along with my white and Mexican and, you know, whatever it happened to be friends at the time. I've had much more positive experiences as an adult. Coming on the show has made me reflect upon it. I work in a hospital, and I've met a lot of African-American people at the hospital. And I think without that kind of, you know, adolescent scenario, yeah. people yeah. are much more respectful and polite. And I've made a lot of good friends that way.
Rochelle Pardue Okimoto. Father is African-American. Father she never knew. Mom is white. Jonathan Chin, you said that earlier, and I'd like to hear from both Jonathan and Rini on this same question about how you look Hispanic, but your last name is Chin. So how did Asian Americans respond to that in your life, the Asian part of your heritage?
Sure. I think that's very interesting. This whole idea, as you evoked earlier, you know, tying in looks to identity. And I feel when I was younger, it was definitely more of an issue, what do I look like? And whereas now it's, what do I feel like? Regardless if I look in the mirror and I don't have, you know, the same sort of, you know, eyes that typically people will say, oh, you know, prominent Asian features, if you will. And I was actually able to go to China after college, and I spent some time over there, and my father came to visit, and we would go around, and you know, and people would ask, and I'd tell them that this is my father, and people would be just blown away. And I'd start speaking a little bit in Chinese, and they would even, you know, have a more shocked face after that. So it's actually quite interesting. Whereas when I was younger, it was more of an issue. Now it's actually something that's been more, I've sort of, you know, gotten more relaxed about it and have been able to sort of, you know, laugh it off, if you will. So that's definitely what's happened for me.
And for you, Rini Yonkegi, of Asian, Hispanic, Caucasian descent. How have people from each of those ethnicities responded to you? To what have you felt from them in terms of either acceptance or rejection?
Well, I think I sort of relate a little bit to Calvin and Rochelle about growing up looking one way, but growing up with a parent of, you know, the other side, because I mostly grew up with my father. And so there,
who's Guatemalan.
Who's Guatemalan, half Guatemalan and half Caucasian, and spent half his life in both of those countries going back and forth, and was born in Guatemala and speaks Spanish fluently, is fully bilingual. So there was kind of an absence of an Asian mother in the household. And yet my father was with these three sort of Asian looking kids, you know, and then, like I said, I was in sort of this white town. So, it wasn't until, I think also, like Rochelle said, at age 18, you started seeking that out. When I was in a small town before, and when I came to, the Bay Area, it was the first time that I'd seen thousands of Asians around me in America, not in Asia. And I'd never been to Asia at that point. I have now, not Korea. But so I think that, you know, all of a sudden I was looking at my other side. And in fact, some of my mother's relatives started emigrating to the United States, and I became very close to that side of the family through cousins and aunts and uncles, more so than my Guatemalan family, who is still in Guatemala. And it's a very difficult country to visit because of the political situation there. And when we were there, there was a war going on. So it wasn't, it's just not an easy place to go. It's quite in shambles, actually.
Mm. Is it always an issue being of biracial background, Calvin McFarlane? Is it something you've ever figure out, or is it something that you're always kind of wrestling with, in part because people aren't entirely sure what to make of you?
Hmm. I definitely struggled with it during my, you know, adolescence and teen years. It was much more of an issue. But, you know, where I'm at now in my life, and I think really past my mid-20s, I became much more secure in my identity. And there's never this continuing question of what am I, what's my identity, you know, where am I going, or what groups do I hang out with, or anything like that. I went through that period during my teenage years, and you know, felt the rejection from numerous groups, and that was challenging. But I think at the end of the day, what I came away with was that I needed to take care of myself, and I needed to find like-minded people that were accepting of who I was first and foremost, and saw past whatever my ethnic background was, whether it's the color of my skin because I'm fair-skinned, or whether it's because my mother's Italian, that none of that needed to matter. It was about who I was, my character. And once I found people like that, it was much easier to get along, if you will.
Calvin McFarlane. We're going to open up our phone lines and hear from our listeners, and we're going to get to Jonathan Chin's point. But first, let's take one call before we head off to our break. We welcome your thoughts on this experience of being of a multiracial or biracial background at 866-733-6786. Michelle has our first comment this morning. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking me. So my mom is African-American and Chinese, and my dad is white. He's Jewish. And when I was little, I really hated being mixed, and I either wanted to wake up one morning and be Japanese or wake up one morning and just be from India, because it was a struggle. And my parents divorced when I was 5, and I think part of that was because his parents didn't approve so much of my mother being African-American, yet that was a family we were always around. So our relationship now is great, but I do remember as a child sort of feeling that rejection of my family, whom I loved and worshiped so much, but we were always the other. So that was hard.
And did what brought about some degree of resolution for that, Michelle?
I think just growing up and just still, you know, being around them all the time. And we had some ugly parts. When I was at San Francisco State, I joined PASU, and a man, I don't remember his name, but he spoke, and I guess he had in the past said some anti-Semitic comments, and my grandparents didn't talk to me for probably about 6 months.
Hmm.
So I really had to work through that, but just knowing that having them in my life was more important than my skin color or needing to, I don't know, be, oh, I'm so black, or I'm so this. So I just had to let it go a little bit.
Michelle, thanks. Thanks mm-hmm. for offering your perspective on this. Jonathan, you wanted to get in a comment.
Oh, sure. I just wanted to dovetail what Calvin was saying. And this whole idea of, for instance, commonality and, you know, being secure with something, or sort of wrestling or going through that journey when you're younger in your adolescence. So for myself, when I meet people of, you know, mixed backgrounds, instantly there's a special bond that we've sort of have gone through similar and also dissimilar stories, but there's always something there, you know, whether that's when I was living in France or in China, that I meet these people and initially, you know, get really excited and we share something on a deeper level.
Do you recall ever having that experience that Michelle just referenced, like wanting to wake up one morning and say, can't I just be one or the other? Does that ring bells with you, Rini?
Yeah, definitely. But also, I think I wanted to bring up the idea of being American, because supposedly America is like the, you know, it's been called the melting pot. And yet, kind of all my life, I've been questioned whether I'm really American, like I'm a real American or not. And then it's interesting how that plays out when you go abroad as well. I actually studied in Spain during high school. And at the time, I had been sent to go live with my mother, who was living in Hawaii. So I sort of applied for this program while I was in Hawaii, which, you know, necessitated a picture of myself. So when I got to my host family in Spain, they were so disappointed to find out that I wasn't Hawaiian, like Hawaiian blooded, and that I was from California, because they told me I should have had blonde hair and blue eyes if I was from California.
Rini Yonkegi, one of our guests this hour, as we talk about the experience of being biracial. We want to hear your thoughts on this experience, what that's been like for you, how you formed your own sense of identity. We'll take those calls when we come back at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. This hour is part of our In My Experience series, where we spotlight the personal stories of people in Northern California. Our topic this morning is being biracial, being from a multiracial, multi-ethnic background, and how that influences one's sense of identity growing up and really throughout life as a parent as well. We welcome your calls and your stories at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us your stories as well at forum@kqed.org. Let's hear next from Elizabeth, who joins us from Fremont this morning. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi. So my mother is Mexican and white, and I grew up, and my father's black, and I grew up in Detroit. So in Detroit, I was, well, people know I was mixed, but I was considered black because there's a large black community. But since I've been in California, my last name is actually Velasco, so everyone assumes that I speak Spanish. And when I don't speak Spanish, they take offense to it and think like, you know, like I think I'm better than them or something, you know, that I'm too good. And I try and explain to them, I grew up in Detroit, you know, it wasn't, there isn't a large Hispanic population there, and but they don't understand that. And I get it all the time. I get people that stop me on the street, like on a regular basis, asking me what I am.
Huh. Elizabeth.
And where I'm from. And I always say I'm from Detroit.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thank you. Jonathan, everyone's responding to what you're saying. Jonathan, you wanted to chime in about sort of expectations. It's like you're supposed to be everything to everyone and have all of these different abilities and representations.
Oh, I can definitely agree with the whole situation of people expecting me to speak Spanish. I've gotten slapped before when I was in Mexico. I mean, not being able to respond, you know, right off the bat. I have learned in school Spanish, but I was never taught by my family. And so it's actually a weird story. Whenever I'm in a Spanish-speaking country, they immediately assume that I either have a speech impediment or that, you know, something's a little off, as opposed to the fact that I can't speak Spanish.
Is there a sense that you have to be all things to all people? I mean, that you have this kind of, by way of your DNA, you're supposed to be everything? Rini?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd said that I just growing up, I always felt like I had to be so many different people in one person. And then, you know, meeting my cousins when I was 11 and 12, they didn't speak my language. And it's you know, it can be kind of exhausting. But I wanted to comment on the caller because it sounded like her father or her mother was biracial. And then we had another caller who was also saying that her mother or father was biracial. And I think that that's an interesting thing, how the kind of generation goes down, because I was also I learned the word Hapa when I came to Berkeley. But I started meeting other Hapas, but it seemed like they were all Hapa, meaning 50% and 50% of something else, whereas I was half Asian and my dad had already had the biracial experience himself and had had a lot of difficulty in that. And it seemed like in passing that down one more generation and it becoming triracial, like Rochelle, you were telling me in the break that you have some kids that might be triracial, that kind of convoluted it even more. And then I felt like I didn't even belong in the Hapa category either.
Yeah, and we are a people, probably any people, who kind of like things simple and straightforward. I mean, you, when someone says, "Well, who are you?" You want just the facts, and it's a more complex thing. I want to turn our discussion slightly to something you mentioned earlier, Rochelle, which is the way in which this has affected your personal lives, who you've been drawn to, who you've dated, how that has affected the way in which you have formed those relationships. How has that happened for you?
Well, I've thought about this many times. Like I was saying, when I was in junior high school was the first time I got a lot of attention from boys, and they were mostly African-American. And at that time, I didn't really find myself very attracted to them. And I think that's because of the faces that I had grown up around. You know, like everyone in my family has kind of this big, very prominent Caucasian nose, kind of big, pointy, you know, you can't, no mistaking it for anything other than I don't know, straight out of Germany or something. And so it was interesting as I kind of evolved through my dating relationships. You know, I tended to be attracted to Caucasian people because that's what I grew up around. And then I got a lot of flack for not being attracted to African-American men. And you know, and I used to wish that I was, because they were, you know, so interested.
They were interested in you.
Yeah, yeah. And here I was pining over some of these other guys that were, you know, they weren't. I'd say where I grew up in Fresno, and there were a lot of guys that were willing to kind of like, you know, I'll kiss you at the party, but, you know, I don't want to bring you home to mom, kind of deal. Hmm. So
how's that played out for the rest of you? Calvin, for you?
Yeah, I grew up in San Francisco, so obviously it's more diverse in San Francisco, albeit segregated. I grew up in San Francisco and went to very mixed schools. And so for me, I can relate to what Rochelle went through as far as it was reversed, where I had, you know, attraction of women towards me, but guys were kind of like standoffish towards me, or kind of
Black guys in particular?
Yeah, I'm sorry. African-American men were – young boys were kind of standoffish towards me, because they felt maybe threatened in some sense, as if there was an attraction towards me by the young African-American ladies. So for me, I can relate to that dynamic, because then I felt like I was treated differently. And, you know, within the African-American community, those that are either biracial with African-American blood or African-American and not biracial can relate to the what we call color struck within the African-American community, where skin tone is really important. And so me being fair-skinned, I dealt with a lot of flack from African-Americans, you know, that, you know, either attacked me or called me names because I was fair-skinned and I looked a certain way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and on the opposite side of the spectrum, an African-American who has a very dark complexion also gets flack. And so there's really, you know, this internal racism within the African-American community. And it's not just within the African-American community. You can go to Asian communities where you have darker Asians who deal with the same issues. And within Hispanic community also, darker Hispanics deal with the same flack from lighter Hispanics. And so I dealt with that, and it was challenging, but at the same time, I didn't have any issues with being, you know, attracted to only one particular race. I mean, I was attracted to girls, period, as a young man. So, you know, that wasn't an issue. I dated across all spectrums.
And let's hear more stories from our listeners this morning. Venus joins us next from Piedmont. Venus, go ahead.
Oh, hi. So I'm Jewish, and my husband is of African descent, but he's English born. So that's a whole different animal than African American, I've come to learn. But racially, he's of African descent and I'm Caucasian, and we have a biracial son who's 3. And we moved to this area because we wanted more families that look like ours. And to confuse matters further, we also have a Caucasian daughter who's mine from a previous relationship. So we're trying to figure out, how do we raise our children in a way where they have a real clear sense of everything that is a part of who they are. And so I want to know from your panel, what do I do as a parent, A, for my biracial son, who is half black and he's half white and he's, you know, living in a world where there's a lot of everything all around him, and also for my Caucasian daughter, who has one black parent and one white parent. And it's all very, I just, as a parent, I want to know, what did your parents do and what did they not do and what did you wish that they would have done differently?
Venus, thanks. Rochelle, you're wrestling with some of those same questions.
Well,
you have a 2-year-old.
Yeah, I can definitely answer parts of that question. I was raised mostly by my grandparents, who chose to ignore the fact that I was half African American, and that was the absolute wrong thing to do. And I'm sure that that's not happening in her household. So I think that you could probably just cut yourself a lot of slack in terms of, you know, you've got mom, you've got dad, you're together, you're raising your kids the best that you can. And so I think that whenever your kids have questions, just answer those questions. And, you know, and be there for support. And I think that's all they really need, because, you know, I made it through with a much less desirable situation. And, you know, your children will probably have struggles at certain times, just like everybody else. But it's all just kind of part of learning and growing. And once they get to my age, hopefully they'll be like me, and that I've just learned to appreciate it. And I really love the fact that I'm different than everybody else. And I love the fact that, you know, I have a half sister who's Caucasian, And, you know, we walk down the street and we are the most opposite. You know, she's tall. Her hair, before she started dyeing it all the time, was blonde. She has blue eyes. You know, I'm short, dark, curly hair. So, I mean, and we love the fact that we're sisters, and we love the fact that we look so different.
Have you thought about your child is just two, but when your child inevitably sort of says, well, now, who am I? How you'll answer?
Right. Yes, my child is definitely going to have those questions because he has me. At least he has me to ask questions, and I'm someone that he can look at that also has brown skin and curly hair and dark eyes. But, you know, the rest of his family that were around here, the Okimotos, they are mostly Japanese, and they're also Caucasian. And he's the only one of his cousins that's not either Hapa or Caucasian. So he's definitely going to have some questions, and I'm just going to tell him, you know, you're this, that, and the other. And I'm going to show him on, you know, a map of the world, like all the different places that he comes from. And, you know, and hopefully we can visit all of those places and just, you know, have him look up to me and his dad as examples and role models.
And back to our calls. Let's hear next from Laura in Oakland. Laura, go ahead.
Oh, thank you for having me. You know, this is a little bit more common, I guess, on what you guys just were talking about. My husband's biracial. He is half English, and his dad came from Uganda. And so he spent some time in Africa, but mostly his experience is coming from England. And I'm from Wisconsin. And, you know, we have two kids that are under 10 right now. And they, you know, they look, I guess, more like me than him, but they don't necessarily even look like each other so much. And so I feel like growing up in Oakland, you know, the questions haven't really come. And to be honest, no one even looks at us in an unusual way. But when we go back to Wisconsin, you know, people certainly look twice at us. And I kind of feel like I don't want to ignore it because we're not going to live in Oakland forever. And they may go off in different places, too. And I guess I was wondering how much of what your panel, how much of how you think about being multiracial is from what you look like versus, you know, identifying culturally like being English or being European, because, you know, certainly we have a lot of English stuff going on in our house, versus what your parents look like and how you compare with your parents. You know, it's, I feel like we're in this weird sheltered place in Oakland, and what is that going to mean when we don't, you know, when we don't move in Oakland anymore?
Okay, Laura, thanks. Anyone want to chime in on Laura's question about what you look like versus all those different cultural issues?
I would say that, you know, first and foremost, I think the previous caller and Laura, the recent caller, being in the Bay Area is probably one of the best places to raise a biracial child. And as she said, she can walk in through Oakland and not really get a stare. I went through that as a, you know, a young child growing up in San Francisco, and I was stared at as I walked down the street with my mother hand in hand. So it's great that she's in that area. But as far as going outside of that area and having to encounter those kind of stares or gawks or what have you, I think that as long as there's a strong sense of identity, whatever that comes to be or how that's molded within your household, as long as a strong sense of identity is in place, that they'll be fine wherever they go, whether it be Wisconsin or Mississippi or somewhere along those lines. And I would also comment that I think that it's important first and foremost for any parents raising biracial children to make sure that their children embrace humanity first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And then the racial and ethnic identities will come secondary. And when that part is embraced, the ethnic identity, for me, you know, I was like Rochelle. I grew up in a white household, an Italian household. But what was interesting is that my mother really had a deep appreciation for African-American music. And so that was really kind of my first exposure to the African-American diaspora.
Do you each have a feeling that you have in some ways either a special responsibility or a special opportunity to bridge differences, to do what you're suggesting, Calvin, that you embrace all of humanity, that you have this sort of unique place to kind of cross all those various divides?
I definitely do. I wanted to respond to the caller as well. And I kind of grew up having this, you know, you get these kind of magical ideas in your head. And I always thought, well, maybe I was placed in this unusual circumstance so that I could be almost like an ambassador for Black people for white people, because I was definitely placed in a lot of scenarios where I'm the only black person that this white person knows, you know? And I think that when I've made friendships with people, that they've kind of gone, oh, okay, you know, we are just basically the same. We are both human beings. And also, I wanted to say about what the caller was saying with her kids going out to different places. I grew up in Fresno, which you think, you hear Fresno, you think, well, it's maybe kind of segregated or very white or something. But my high school was actually 50% Caucasian and 50% other. It was pretty diverse. And then I went to UC Santa Barbara, which was very Caucasian. And that was kind of a shock for me. And people there would come up to me and say, like, oh, you're black. Well, you must listen to rap music and, you know, stuff that was weird like that. But at the same time, I actually ended up making some of my best friends that I have to this day in Santa Barbara, you know, a bunch of Caucasian girls that I just love to death. So, you know, I think once you kind of get over these little humps, you know, like, you know, once you're in an unusual situation like that, they might find something special, like, you know, lifelong friendships.
Can I talk Rini, about that?
Go ahead.
I think that you just become very adaptable. You have to be adaptable to different situations, because from birth you're thrown into disparate situations that you kind of have to deal with in different ways.
Do you find yourself then also being a different person? I mean, if you're in a group that's more Asian or more Hispanic or more African American, whatever it happens to be, that you kind of shift part of your being?
I think you absolutely do. And I mean, I think, you know, I've striven, or is that the word, strived for, you know, sort of more of a holistic identity. And that's hard sometimes, because I have, it's not just the ethnicities, it's the culture, you know, it's just so different. There's different mindsets. Yeah. And that you have to kind of adjust to. And I think it does make us people who can talk to all walks of life quite often.
Jonathan.
Sure. Just to respond to the two callers, I think growing up, I really appreciate my from my parents was the fact that they were able to sort of embrace me being multicultural. And so we were able to sort of celebrate many different holidays, whether that was Chinese New Year. Every Sunday we would go get dim sum. So it didn't necessarily matter what I looked like, but I had this special bond with my parents. You know, we did a lot of cultural things. And so I felt very strong in that sense from an identity perspective. And, you know, I was able to do all these activities that are a big part of a certain culture or ethnicity. And so it doesn't really matter what I look like, but I partook in that with my family, which was very special.
Do you feel, Calvin, this sense that if you're with a group of African Americans, that you're you become more in that as opposed to being with whites or being with Hispanics? I know you're engaged to a Latina woman. Do you find yourself sort of invariably kind of shifting depending on who you're with?
I don't find myself shifting, because part of my identity is African American, and I went to, you know, schools with African Americans, and definitely ran around with groups of African Americans as a teenager. So I definitely don't feel like I shift. I feel like I could become more comfortable and more leisure in maybe my vernacular, and kind of let it hang out, if you will. And let loose. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if I'm in a professional setting, and whether, you know, it's a room full of African Americans or it's a room full of Caucasians, my communication, my demeanor, the way I carry myself will be professional first and foremost. And so I don't so much shift, but I feel it's a comfort level thing for me.
To Mark in Los Gatos. Mark, go ahead.
Hello. I'm English, and it's kind of ironic that while waiting on the phone here, I've heard two other people who have relationships with people from England. But I grew up in Nigeria and South Africa, attended school in England, and then went to university out here. And I had to be honest, when I came to this country, the race thing just hit me in the face like I've never experienced before. I mean, I've lived with many different races. In America, people call themselves African American, but in England, they don't call themselves African English or, you know, Italian English. I mean, I find that out in England, people just blend in, just people, and so they're from a different place, and that's fine. They mix with everybody. You know, to add that, when I was at university, all the black kids that were playing football all hung out together, and they were like a little microcosm, and they did their own thing together, and there was a black student union to take care of their needs. But all the Africans that came to the university, none of them were part of the black student union. They wanted to have nothing to do with it. They consequently ended up marrying, you know, Caucasian ladies, most of them. And I just found, I don't know whether there's something in America that people identify with race before anything else, but I found it really different. I mean, even living in Africa, I was embraced as just another person. But when I came out here, you kind of fit into little boxes and
Interesting.
People identify themselves.
Let's get some response to that, Mark. Thank you. Do we care too much about hyphens, you know, in this country, that we're sort of African American, Latino American, whatever American? Rini?
I think we absolutely do. I mean, having been to other countries, and I was talking to Jonathan about living in Paris, I don't know what your experiences in Paris were, but when I went to Paris, people did not ask me what I was. And it was the first time in my life that someone did in a Western country that someone did not ask me what I was. And I'm not sure, you know, and I was talking to Judy about this.
Our producer, Judy Campbell.
Yeah, that it might be because they just have a longer history of, you know, being closer to other countries and other cultures. You know, they're a stone's throw away from Africa. I don't know if that's what it is, or they've just kind of gotten over it. We're a newer country that started on kind of not so great grounds in terms of the Native Americans that were here.
Is it something we should get over, or is it important to hold on to those hyphens? And does it matter, you know, sort of which box you check on the census form? Because you can check many now. It used to be you could only check one. What do you feel about that? Is it something we should just get over, or is it holding on to that important?
Holding on to your cultural background, I think, is important. I mean, I really love learning about different cultures. So, I mean, I want everyone to embrace the culture that they're from. However, I think that sometimes if you're trying to force people into a box, as we've been talking about, that separates people from one another. And I think I'm in favor of, obviously, with my biracial self, my biracial husband, and my triracial son, that, you know, I want everyone to blend. And if you choose not to blend, that's fine. But I basically kind of want everyone to just get along well.
And do you check every box on those census questions? How do you respond to that?
You know, sometimes I remember asking the first time I ever had to check one of those boxes off in like fifth grade. I went up to my teacher and I said, "What am I supposed to put?" And she said, "Well," she didn't know what to say. She said, "Well, just put whatever your family is, dear, you know." And since then, I've been checking, you know, sometimes both, sometimes one, sometimes, you know, I really actually enjoy the other box because I feel like I am the other.
Let's go around on the boxes once. Jonathan, what do you
think? I definitely think that's very interesting. You know, the whole idea of checking off the boxes, it's either do I check dad or do I check mom? Why am I forced to make this choice? Yeah. I'm so young, I really don't know what I am. Why am I sort of, you know, I have to make a decision. Whereas now, which is great, you can actually check off multiracial or multi.
So you check off multiple? Yeah. What do you do, Calvin?
I check African American. I think once in a while I may check other, maybe in the mood I'm in. I don't know. But I usually check African American.
Rini?
I also really enjoyed being able to check three boxes or more, you know, because then there's Pacific Islander and all this, you know, and it, yeah. You felt like you could kind of ride outside the lines in some ways on that one.
Yeah, rebel.
Some comments coming in on our website and by email. Gia writes in, "I'm black. My husband is white. I'm pregnant with our first child. We live in San Francisco. Do any of the guests have suggestions or stories about what their parents did or tips of what my husband and I could do that could make our child's life easier growing up as a biracial kid?" Lots of comments coming in about that and obviously concern about mm-hmm. how to approach that. Thoughts for Gia? Calvin?
I'd like to share that for me, you know, one of the turning points for me with regards to getting in touch with my African-American identity, as I mentioned, I had an aunt who reached out to me, but I also had the experience of joining an organization called the Omega Boys Club. Many San Franciscans are probably familiar with the organization, but it's an organization that really promotes African-Americans attending college post-high school, obviously. And so I engaged with that organization, and they took me on a college tour of historically black colleges. And I was able – and that was the first time I had gotten out of San Francisco, and I actually walked onto a campus and looked at the campus, and I saw nothing but African-Americans going to school. I mean, it looked like it was out of a movie, but in the movie it's – white people on campus going to school. But this was real time for me. And so for me, that was like the first like turning point for me to see something completely different, and which gave me a sense of pride of what African Americans were doing and the contributions that they bring to the U.S. And so I would always suggest that make sure that both identities are embraced. The historical context is brought in so that that child understands both sides and the accomplishments and the contributions that the family and other African Americans and Caucasians, for that matter, have made, so that that sense of pride is instilled.
Just have a moment or two left. So just a last thought perhaps from the rest of you on that question of coming to terms and finding pride in that, a sort of sense of confidence, I guess, in that mixture that you each are. Renee?
Well, you know, we don't talk about we say the first black president when we refer to Barack Obama, and he's half white and half black. And I hear that he checked African-American on his census box, right? And so that is – I think it's about self-identification. And I would say that also for people who have young children who were asking about that, it's possibly you could tell them that you could identify as whatever you want, and it doesn't have to be imposed on by, you know, somebody else.
Jonathan?
Oh, definitely. I definitely agree with what Rini is saying. And it's also very important to, for me growing up, at the beginning, you know, you're not this and you're not that. And just letting myself pick what I feel most comfortable with identifying.
And Rochelle?
Well, I'd like to get back to what they said in terms of, like, you know, this is maybe a black and white parents, and then what is their child going to experience? And one thing that I learned later on in adulthood is what it means to be African American is something I've really had to search for. And I understand why some people don't say that they're mixed race when they're African American. And that's because most African Americans are mixed race. They usually have Caucasian and African and Native American blood in them. And so I've embraced that. And I've also, I just like to look forward to, oh, there goes the music. Calvin.
No, that's okay. We do have to bring it to a close. But thank you. Thank you for that thought, actually, of embracing all of it. We also want to note that if you visit our website, you can read more about the experiences that people have responded to with this, and also photographs that our intern, Michelle Gache, took about this topic as well. That's on our website, kqed.org. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.